Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we hear about exciting plans for a new wildlife hospital. Three transition year students show off their latest publication, A Bee's Life, which they've written and illustrated. And we see shocking evidence of cannibalism in birds.
Now, where we are now, we're just out the back of your restaurant, which is on O'Connell Street. And you were here, you saw something really, really unusual. Tell us.
Yeah, well, I was walking along, I seen a seagull attacking a pigeon in the sky, and I quickly got my phone out. The pigeon had dropped to the floor, and the seagull started attacking it. And I saw the seagull really, really going to town on the pigeon, and eating the pigeon.
Eating it,
and taking, eating every organ I'd say the pigeon had in its tiny body, but sure, he devoured it.
Oh, I have to tell you, it's a bit of a gruesome video. Oh dear, but we bring you all sorts of stories on this programme, as you know. Well, today, it's the 2nd of December, and as I record this programme, I am standing on Sandyman Strand in Dublin, part of the Dublin Bay Biosphere. I'm looking right across Dublin Bay. It's a beautiful clear day, a little bit brisk, but beautifully clear. I can see Howth, and I can see the Irish Ferries ship coming out of Dublin Port, and to my right I can see Dunleary and the south coast of Dublin, and directly ahead of me I'm looking at the remnants of the old Merrion Baths, covered in graffiti and bizarrely in yellow, Helen and Derek with a big X at the end. I know who Derek is, but I don't know who Helen is. I didn't do it. But it's a beautiful day today, and I'm just wondering, as I stand here with the water lapping at my feet, what is it like in Cork? What's the view like on Harper's Island in Cork? Who better to ask than our man in Cork, ornithologist and author, and indeed, guide to the Antarctic and Arctic, Jim Wilson. Jim.
Derek, how are we doing? Yes, it is absolutely glorious here too. It is just a perfect winter's day. Sun is shining. I'm overlooking the wetland area of Harper's Island Wetlands, and it couldn't be better. Lots of ducks out on the water. Little egrets hunting along the way, and golden plover overhead. And you can hear the train go by. That's the Cork Cove line. So you can actually reach Harper's Island Wetlands even if you don't have a car or you want to leave it at home. It is a really fantastic spot. We've put in lots of new facilities which will be opening up to the public next weekend. We've got new ponds, we call them scrapes. We've got a new hide. You may remember when you were down here the first time, we looked at the first hide that was put up when we opened Harper's Island Wetlands to the public for the first time. And now we've built another one. But just to stand here, and I'm so privileged because, of course, officially it's closed during the week at the moment, so I'm in here all on my own. I have it to myself. It is just wetland heaven.
And it sounds it too, Jim. The last time I was with you was, I think, 2017. A beautiful space for everybody.
It is, absolutely. I mean, this is not just for bird watchers. I mean, we always say in Birdwatch Ireland that the birds really are like flagship species. They're very obvious. They're easy enough to see, you know, unlike some of the more obscure insects and things like that. So people can actually relate to them fairly quickly. You grow up seeing them around the place, even if you're not a sort of card-carrying bird watcher. As a result of that, the birds act really as just a symbol for all of biodiversity, for all the wildlife. So anybody coming here can come along, even if you have no interest in birds, but you might be interested in other things, butterflies, flowers, all aspects of wildlife are catered for here on Harper's Island Wetlands, for sure.
Now, as I speak to you, Jim, I could just see a flock of golden plover flying off in the distance. And my God, they're skimming the surface of the water. And they're up now and they're doing a bit of a loop. It's a bit like watching a murmuration of starlings. It's extraordinary.
It is. It's exactly the same principle. The flock, the way it moves. It's a bit like three-dimensional traffic, really. If you're in a four-lane highway, for example, if a car comes towards you from the right, you will instinctively steer to the left so that it doesn't hit you, and the car next to you will steer to the left. So from somebody looking at a distance, it looks like the three cars simultaneously just moved in synchronized way to the left, whereas that wasn't the case. You reacted in a split second to the car next to you moving towards you. And those flocks, that's how they end up doing all those fabulous, you know, shapes in the sky. And the golden plover do them just like the starlings. And we've got a lovely flock of them here in Harper's Island wetland, not to be outdone by Dublin, of course, down here in Cork. We have our own golden plover flock, and they come over the island regularly during the day in the winter.
Aerial ballet, Jim, aerial ballet. Of course, it's easier for the birds to see what's beside them because their eyes are on the side of their head.
Yes, that's right. Of course, they can see all round. In fact, a golden plover, if you take a photograph of it from behind, you can actually see the eyes almost sticking out on either side of the head. So while they don't have good binocular vision like we have with the eyes in front, they've got an all-round view, which of course they need, because like a lot of the wetland birds that we find around our shores, they're out in the open, they're very exposed. And there was a peregrine falcon came through here this morning, I heard it on the grapevine, and they'd be looking out for an aerial attack by something like a peregrine falcon or even a sparrowhawk, and so they need to be able to see in front and behind and at the side all at the same time.
Now, tell me about any unusual visitors you've had in the last year or two. Bird-wise,
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yes, we've lots of unusual visitors here. But on the bird front, we've done very well. I mean, we've had, like, an American golden plover, close cousin and very similar in appearance to our own European golden plover. They nest in the high Arctic in North America. And in the autumn, when they're finished nesting, they actually fly down the west coast of North America, down to South America, almost down to the bottom sometimes. A huge migration. And then when they come back up, they come back up through South America. But instead of going up the west coast the same way they came down, they actually go up the centre of North America, back up to their breeding grounds. And one of them obviously got its compass totally mixed up, and it ended up crossing the Atlantic and landing here at Harper's Island Wetlands. And that was a great treat for the rarity hunters. But we also had an osprey. Listeners to the programme have heard us talking about ospreys in the past, because they breed in Britain. They also breed in Scandinavia. They breed in many parts of Europe. In fact, they breed all around the world. They're a very widespread species. And they're like a fish eagle. They actually literally catch fish by... You might have seen it on television. They come down and they grab it with their big long talons, a fish that's just on the surface, and they carry it off. And they always point it forward, by the way. They never hold the fish sideways, because, of course, aerodynamically, it's better to have the fish's head pointing into the wind. So that's what they do. They point it forward and they eat the fish. Now, this bird was probably a Scandinavian bird, or maybe even a Scottish bird, that was beginning to take its long migration down to Africa, south of the Sahara, and stopped off here and loved it so much, stayed a few weeks. It wasn't just seen in Harper's Island wetlands, it was actually seen around the harbour as well. An unusual visitor. So when we're out and about on Harper's Island wetlands, we're not just seeing the local stuff and the ones we normally see. There's always a chance of something strange and exciting. And because we've improved the habitat for the wetland birds in particular here, that obviously is good for the fish and all the other marine creatures that live in the water on Harper's Island. And they gain from that. And so God knows what's going to come in here in the years to come.
Jim, I have a suggestion for you. One is to stock that body of water with fish and prevent them from getting out. That's the first thing. And the second thing is to put up a platform for the osprey. And who knows, maybe it will nest in Aviemore in Scotland. The osprey nest site there is a major tourist attraction.
Derek, that's not as crazy an idea as it might sound to some of the listeners, because it has worked in other parts of the world, where they put up a platform basically on a pole, like a telephone pole or electricity pole. What you need then is you need the birds stopping off on their way north. So when they're coming back from Africa, quite a few of them will pass through Ireland on the way north. We get records every spring. But what you want is one to turn up in Harper's Island in April, May, that time of the year. And then if it sees a platform, it might try to set up a territory. Of course, you need more than one, as you know. But with a bit of luck, if a few of them started turning up, it is not beyond the bounds of possibility. As for stocking fish in that, Harper's Island wetland, it's not really like wildlife park or a zoo. We literally are just conserving the habitat and letting nature do its thing. But there appears to be plenty of fish there. In fact, we had a couple of exotic visitors from Forta Wildlife Park, which is within shouting distance of me here. A couple of pelicans came in. Now, we had to get them back to Forta Wildlife Park because they were scaring the living daylights out of everything in the place, because they're huge. And when they come into land, they're like a big Boeing 747 and everything just got scared away. But they're back in Forta now. But they really liked the place because there was a lot of fish here and there still is.
I think I heard an oyster catcher there, I think.
We get oyster catchers in here too, Derek. They feed out on the mud flats and on the mussel beds not too far from us. And then they come in here at high tide to roost, to rest and to preen and to wash and have a snooze. Also, they sometimes will feed in the grass. We've lots of grassland here as well on the island. And we can get a good number of them coming in. They're fantastic. And what I'm glad you mentioned oyster catchers, actually, because I was only just reading an email the other day from Barry O'Mahony. Barry's been on the programme before. He's a ringer. He's a trained, qualified ringer. So what he does is he catches birds, he puts metal bands on them, and we can study migration through that. And Barry really runs our migration studies unit here at Harper's Island Wetlands. And Barry sent me an email, a record of an oyster catcher he caught, and he caught it earlier this year, and it was ringed in Orkney.
Oh.
Orkney in 2011. So quite incredible that we now have a really solid link with somewhere like Orkney. This oyster catcher was caught up there and ringed, and it ended up here for the winter. Really fantastic.
Now, that's off the north coast of Scotland, the Orkney Islands and archipelago up there. It's quite a distance, or is it a long distance? I remember reading a story about an oyster catcher on Orkney, Jim, that had actually nested on a roundabout in the middle of a busy road, of all things. But is that some journey? Is that unusual to nest like that? And is it a big journey for an oyster catcher to make?
Well, to answer your first question about where it nests there on the middle of a roundabout, that's not that unusual. I've been to the Netherlands many times with good friends over there. You often see them nesting in the central aisle of a dual carriageway. You see them on roundabouts. You see them in all sorts of strange places. And the reason they're doing that is they feel safer, because the traffic actually makes them safe from land predators, particularly foxes, but also for the eggs it could be rats and all sorts of other things. But if you're in the middle of a dual carriageway or you're in the middle of a roundabout, boy, are you safe, because you're nesting on the ground. You're right out in the open. And of course, the problem arises then when the young hatch out. They're like ducklings. They're able to feed for themselves. They're able to walk and run and all that sort of things as soon as they're hatched. Within the day, they're up and running full speed. But the problem is they're now in the middle of a roundabout and there's not a lot of food there. So mom and dad have to get them off the roundabout, cross the road and to somewhere where they can start feeding. So that's the only problem you'd have with nesting in there, but not unusual at all. And as for the distance, through our studies, like a lot of the work Barry O'Mahony's been doing here, we've pieced together the migration movements of the oyster catchers, and a lot of them come to Ireland from Scotland, Scandinavia, Iceland. We get quite a few coming here from Iceland. We've learned that by putting the colour rings on. Remember we talked about the godwits on the programme, and we put these coloured rings on them so we don't have to catch them again. Well, we've done the same with oyster catchers, and lo and behold, quite a number of the Icelandic oyster catchers like to spend the winter in Ireland.
Jim, just to tell our listeners what you've got on offer for them there over the Christmas period.
Okay, well, actually, I've just walked down from the Nature Trail, which is a new 2 kilometre track around the island, showing you lots of different types of wildlife, especially non-wetland wildlife. So we're talking about countryside birds. So that's going to be there. I'm now coming into the second hide that I mentioned that was built earlier this year. And boy, is this one deluxe. I must say, Glaunthan Men's Shed, when they build hides, they really build hides. I think I could move in here. You should see the finish on it, the windows, the roof, everything. It is just top class. And it will be open to the public from next weekend. So we'll now have the two hides opened, plus that 2 kilometre nature trail. And as I look out through the windows here from the second hide, we call it the scrape hide, because we've created two large, they look like ponds, but in the business we call them a scrape because they're not very deep. It's just like scraping a foot or two of the surface away. And we've created two massive ponds right in front of this hide that has just been built so that when people come, they don't even have to open the windows. The glass is fantastic. They can sit here and they can look out onto Harper's Island wetland. And I'm just distracted, by the way, Derek, while I'm trying to talk to you here, because there are so many birds out there and so many things going on at the moment. It is just brilliant. And if you want to bring a flask with you or your sandwiches, I can think of no better place to come than here. I mean, this is really medicine for the mind. And I'm not just joking when I say that. I'm very serious. I think with the type of lifestyle we're growing accustomed to, which is very fast, very fast, very demanding, we need to be able to go to places where we can relax. And it has been proved over and over again that going to quiet green areas, looking at wildlife, actually helps us mentally. And I think on that level, as well as all the other levels of bird watching and biodiversity, this is a great place to come to. And it is due to the hard work of a lot of people. Birdwatch Ireland, both locally, the Cork branch, and nationally, for supporting it and going with it from the very, very start and pushing it along. The people of Glanthorn, again, without them, it wouldn't have happened, particularly the Glanthorn Community Association, Tidy Towns, and the Men's Shed. The Men's Shed have been just incredible. They've taken on this project and ran with it like you wouldn't believe. And then Cork County Council, people like Sharon Casey and Parig Lynch, you know, at the coalface, looking after us, making sure we do everything right. And then the council itself for supplying the funding to make it all happen. So a great example, and I would hope other local authorities might come and visit and take a leaf out of our book, that so someday in every county in Ireland we'll have a Harper's Island wetland or something similar.
Tell me, is it open over the Christmas? Can I go there on Christmas Day or Stephen's Day?
Okay, Derek. Opening hours at the moment are weekends, that's Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 4 at weekends. Over the Christmas, as we've done in previous years, if we can get our volunteer rota together, we will do our best to have it open Christmas, Stephen's Day, New Year's Day, things like that. But the best thing for people to do is join us on Facebook or on Twitter, Harper's Island Wetlands. You'll find us using that. And if you're on that, you will get notifications or you can look it up and see what the opening times are. Because, for example, if one of our group feels like, you know, Christmas, I want to get out and stretch my legs, I'll go down and I'll open up Harper's and I'll close it later. Well, then we can open it. That's the way it works. We don't have staff, you know, we're a volunteer-led group. And so as a result, we will open it when we can. But for sure, at the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, 10 to 4, it will definitely be open. And then we hope over time to increase that, and hopefully eventually it'll be open 7 days a week. That is our ultimate aim.
Well, it's a fantastic success story as far as I'm concerned. A great project, a great dream, and good things come from dreams, and people have to think about them and then they have to make a lot of effort and make it happen. And you've done that in Cork with all of the people involved. So congratulations to everybody there. We'll make sure we put some pictures up so you can see the variety of bird species. All the pictures taken by Jim, and thank you very much indeed, Jim, for allowing us to use those pictures on our website. It's rte.ie/Mooney. When I began speaking to you earlier, Jim, I was mentioning at the top of the programme we're going to feature a story now about a gull attacking and killing a pigeon. Cannibal birds in Dublin, have you ever heard the like?
Ah, yeah. Gulls are big scavengers. I mean, they'll eat whatever they can get their hands on. They're carnivore, largely carnivore, almost exclusively carnivore as far as I know, but there's always one exception, I'm sure, out there. But yeah, no, I mean, I've seen them kill other gulls, especially the herring gulls, especially the bigger ones. Black-headed gulls, the smaller ones, tend not to be, you know, into big meat, whereas the herring gulls for sure would take any sick bird, any injured bird that they can come across. But you don't often see it, and especially a pigeon, the poor thing. But it appears that herring gulls have the constitution and the stomach of a riveted cast iron boiler. I mean, it's they can eat almost anything and it seems not to affect them at all. So, yeah, I look forward to hearing and listening to that item, but definitely not unusual.
Well, it's coming up right now because Mooney Goes Wild listener Carl Ryan, he's one of the co-owners of Flanagan's restaurant on O'Connell Street. He witnessed this and made a little video and sent it in to us. And he was wondering how common this is. So basically what we have is a gull attacking and killing and eating a pigeon. The video's on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. We sent Terry Flanagan and Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland to investigate.
Now, where we are now, we're just out the back of your restaurant, which is on O'Connell Street. And you were here, you saw something really, really unusual. Tell us.
Yeah, well, I was walking along, I seen a seagull attacking a pigeon in the sky, and I quickly got my phone out. The pigeon had dropped to the floor, and the seagull started attacking it, basically.
And then you took out your phone and you started filming it.
I started filming it, and what I witnessed was incredible.
Yeah,
was
tell us what you saw.
So what I saw was, I saw the seagull really, really going to town on the pigeon, and eating the pigeon.
Eating it,
and taking, eating every organ, I'd say, the pigeon had in its tiny body, but sure. Yeah.
Now, I've seen the video, and the one thing I'm amazed at, and I suppose most people are too, is the size of the gull beside the pigeon. It's huge.
It's huge. It's completely, like, when you see them fly in the sky, you say, yeah, he's big, and the pigeon is normal, but when you see them on the ground, and in such fashion of the way I've saw it, it was towering over the pigeon. The pigeon looked tiny towards it. Yeah. You know, it was really incredible, but he devoured it.
Right. Well, with us as well is Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland. Niall, have you seen anything like this before?
I've never seen it in such visceral terms as on the video. It is pretty striking there. I have seen herring gulls, because that's the species in question. It's a herring gull. I have seen them attack and kill other things. I've seen them kill puffins. I've actually seen them actually hunt ducks as well. Right. So they're opportunists. When they see an opportunity for food, they'll take it. So they'll often scavenge things they find in the streets. They'll sometimes catch fish. They'll go along beaches. They eat rats and mice, and if they get a chance to get a pigeon, they will. It's, you know, it would be a difficult thing for them to do. So this particular gull seems to become quite specialised in this, because as you can see from the video, it actually is taken out from the sky. The pigeon's injured there on the street, and then the gull comes in and finishes it off. And of course, that's the way nature is. There's nothing right or wrong about that. It's just, you know, there's no judgment there. It's just the way the birds behave. The animals kill other animals.
And of course, their numbers have increased considerably. Carl, what's it been like? I know you've been here for about 30 or 35 years in O'Connell Street. What was it like back in the 1980s regards gulls?
Well, the gulls, you wouldn't see much of them. It seems to be in the last 10 years we've seen a dramatic number of gulls just taking over the city, from snatching sandwiches from people's hands on O'Connell Street. From what I witnessed on the video, like, I haven't seen anything like it. They seem to be everywhere now.
And have you any ideas to why?
Maybe there's plenty of food in the city now, but I think the bins in the city now are all divided up into food bins and cardboard bins and they're just scavenging now. It just seems to be the city is so populated that they're getting food at every hand's turn, and it's a haven for them.
And they've learned, of course, where you are here. This is food.
This is food. Yeah, because there would be a lot of restaurants and fast food outlets along here. So 3 a.m. in the morning, we're closing up and stuff like that. You would see them, like, people throwing half the hamburgers away. They're watching. They're there. They're watching. If somebody lets a chip out of their hand, they're down and they have food.
And have you had any other experiences with birds, say, taking food?
Well, I used to feed them when I was, like, going back a couple of years ago, because I used to love watching them and fly. So I would throw something, some type of food up to them, and they would catch in midair.
And these would be gulls, were they?
These would be gulls. And then I used to whistle them, and they'd come in their droves to be 20, 30, 40, 50 of them, and they'd be just. They just come from everywhere. The numbers are huge.
Niall, what can you say about the numbers increasing? Can you give us a reason for it?
Well, you mentioned there, Terry, that the numbers of these herring gulls have increased, but actually nothing could be further from the truth. Their numbers have decreased massively. Certainly within Dublin, we are seeing them more relying on food here, getting handouts and scavenging around the city. But nationally, their population has declined by 90% in 30 years, which puts them on the endangered list here. And what's actually happening is these birds are coming now into the city as a last resort. It's the sign of a species in crisis. And one of the big issues that happens is that, I mean, walking along O'Connell Street here to come here today to meet with you about this, to see loads of people flinging chips on the ground for them, feeding them when they come up to them. It is really important that these birds do not associate humans with food, because they're big, they're aggressive, and then what happens is people think they're doing a good thing by feeding these gulls, and they're flocking down, and then what happens is somebody's walking along the street and the gull decides, there's a human, humans feed me, I can depend on them for food. They come and grab a sandwich, or they grab a, you know, they hurt somebody, and then there's calls for the gulls to be killed. So the gulls are losing the run of themselves, they're dangerous, they're violent, they're aggressive, they're just behaving like wild animals. You have to remember that these are wild animals, they're not pets, and people shouldn't feed them. It's important they don't learn to associate humans with food. And it's also important that we recognise why they're here in Dublin City. I mean, it's a coastal city. There have always been gulls around this. For the last 1,000 years, there have been gulls in Dublin. However, more and more of them are now nesting on rooftops within the city. And that's because their proper nesting colonies, the islands around Dublin Bay and further afield, they've become overrun with non-native predators like rats and mink, and indeed with human beings who are out there causing disturbance. And the gulls then go for the next best option, which is an urban island surrounded by traffic. It may as well be surrounded by water, they're nice and secure from predators there. And that's one of the things that brings them into conflict with people during the summer months. When they have eggs and chicks, they're very territorial, very protective of their chicks, trying to be good parents. And that can lead to conflict. Now, this time of the year, that doesn't happen. Gulls aren't attacking people because they're not territorial at all. So they're not attacking people for that reason. Sometimes what will happen is some gulls who've learned to associate human beings with food handouts think that they're entitled to food, and they come up and they get very pushy and aggressive. And sometimes people get intimidated by them because they're big. And they just drop the food. And then, as everyone says, that these gulls need to be controlled. It's we humans that need to control our behaviour. There is too much food waste and litter on the streets in Dublin, and the gulls are coming and scavenging that. Now, if the gulls weren't here, what else is going to scavenge that food? Rats and mice. That's what would happen. So we see the gulls doing it during the day and cleaning up the streets. At night, when people aren't watching, there are lots of other predators, or scavengers, I should say, that do that, principally rats and mice, also foxes. So the gulls are actually doing us a service.
Carl, have you seen the gulls attacking rats?
I haven't seen that. I have seen a magpie attack a rat and take him away, and I have another fascinating video of that. I didn't get to the start of it where if he actually killed the rat, but I actually seen him, you know, picking at him good and hard for about 1 minute and then taking him along off to a rooftop with him, and the rat was a good size.
Well, would you say that the numbers of rats have decreased in the last 20 or 30 years if the numbers of gulls have increased?
That I wouldn't really... I don't see much rats. I, you know, if they come out late at night, maybe I'm not out late enough to see them. But I see gulls late, like when I'm out at night. So, you know, I see a lot of gulls at night outside the likes of fast food outlets on O'Connell Street.
And they're flying through the night, no problem.
12 o'clock to 3 a.m. is their peak time. And they seem like I wouldn't see a pigeon at night time, just gulls, because there's a lot of food at 3 a.m.
Do the pigeons keep away from the gulls?
They are very afraid of them, yeah.
Really?
Well, yeah, that's what it seems to be.
And so if there's food on the ground, and
the gull wins.
Yeah.
The gull comes in and it's one gollop and it's gone, and the pigeon will take 5 minutes to eat the piece the gull has just ate. Yeah. But from what I've seen and what I've captured on video, if I was a pigeon, I'd stay away from the gulls too.
If you look at the way pigeons do it as well, when they grab a piece of food, let's say a chip or something, they have to pick it up and they shake it and shake it to try and break a bit off. And it's very messy, and they don't get, it's not a very efficient way to feed. The gull would just come and just wolf the whole thing down. They can open their mouths much, much wider. They're a much bigger bird anyway, but their mouths open much wider. They can gulp much more food down, and they have a much larger area for storing food within their bodies. Particularly during the breeding season, what they do is they gorge themselves on as much food as they can. Then they fly back to their chicks in the nest, and then they regurgitate that food, which sounds pretty unpleasant, but it's a very efficient way for them. Bring the food
and of course
back.
They semi-digest it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And all these enzymes get passed across, and all sorts of beneficial bacteria and all of these things that are benefiting the immune systems of these chicks as well.
Well, Carl, you've videoed a number of interesting clips.
Yes.
What's the most interesting thing you've seen with the gulls here in O'Connell Street?
Well, the most interesting thing I've seen was the eating of the pigeon.
Right.
Like, it was gross, you know, like, and there was blood and guts, and the seagull was just happy to leave. I went back at the end and I had a look, and there was just a feathered carcass with absolutely nothing left. Nothing.
And a happy gull flying away.
And a happy gull flying away with a nice red chest. And it was amazing.
And when you showed me the video there of the gull, I could see that what it went for first was the internal organs. You could see it going for the liver and for the heart and these parts of the bird, because they're the richest in nutrients for it. You'll often find that sometimes birds and also rats will go for the brain of a prey as well, because a brain and the eyes, unpleasant as that sounds, because they're also very high in nutrition. And then if time permits, then they go on and eat some more of the muscle and so forth. But if you're on a busy street and your food could be stolen by somebody else, or a car's going to come along and scare you away, it makes sense to get the maximum benefit as quickly as you can. So they go straight for the internal organs.
So the maximum benefit is the nice, juicy internal organs, not what you're serving in the restaurant.
No, not what I'm serving in the restaurant. So gulls are not welcome in the restaurant.
Thank you, Carl and Terry and Niall. I've just dropped my script on the sand, so I'll just pick it up. There we go.
Oh, what a glorious thing to be, a healthy grown-up, busy, busy bee, whiling away the passing hours, pinching all the pollen from the cauliflowers. I'd like to be a busy, busy bee, being just as busy as a bee can be, flying round the garden, the sweetest ever seen, taking back the honey to the dear old queen. Buzz, 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 honey bee, buzz, if you like, but don't sting me. Buzz, 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 honey bee, buzz, if you like, but don't sting me.
Now we turn to something that you might be interested in getting as a Christmas gift for a small person in your life, because three transition year students from Killinagh Presentation School in County Offaly have written, designed and illustrated a book especially for children entitled A Bee's Life. In the book, Emma Lynham, Hannah Corbell and Niamh Dygan share some wonderful facts about bees, like, did you know that bees are found on every continent except for Antarctica? Did you know that? Or that a bee, this is interesting, will only make 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey in its lifetime. Can that be true? Or that honey found inside Egypt's 3,000-year-old pyramids is still perfectly edible. Don't let me stop you if you get a jar of it. John Riley went off to meet the authors.
Thanks, Derek. It's starting to rain gently here in Dewey Woods on the edge of Clara Bog in County Offaly. And I'm here with authors Hannah Corbell and Niamh Dygan. Hannah, how did the project come about?
So we first started our project when we went into transition year, and we decided to do a little book about bees and the environment. I think it was kind of the first sort of thing we thought of, as it would be a great genre for children. Children are learning about bees and the environment now, especially because they're the future, and because of climate change and global warming, it's very important for children at a young age to learn about bees and the environment and what's happening to our earth. So I thought if we targeted children, it would be easier to write a story, first of all, that children be able to read, and a great way to target schools for children to learn about the bees.
One of the things, as I understand it, you were doing, Niamh, was looking at the storyline and the idea of that there would be this one particular bee, Betty Bee, and a day in her life. Was this idea to make it, I suppose, kind of like more accessible to younger children?
Yeah, we thought by like making it just about one bee, there would kind of be a story for them to follow along, and they'd get like attached to the bee, so they'd want to know what would happen to it in the story, and it'd be more interesting to read for them.
Do you think that you learned a lot about bees yourself through doing the book, like lots of stuff that you didn't know previously?
Definitely by doing the book I learned like so much more. Like at the start we kind of looked up all like facts about bees, and we went to like a beekeeping talk at the start, so we kind of have an idea of, you know, what bees actually do. Like, we didn't want to write anything down that wouldn't be true.
I think that I read somewhere in the book that there was honey found in the pyramids in Egypt that was thousands of years old and was still absolutely fine.
There were so many more bees back then than there was now, that like they were so fantastic in the way that they were able to like reproduce and have so much honey. And like,
yeah. Were there more bees than thousands of years ago, do you think?
I think definitely there was. I think the way that people treat the environment now, I think they're kind of dwindling away almost. Like, they're nearly extinct, some types of bees.
Including some Irish bees are also kind of like threatened as well, are they?
Yeah, I'd say so. Especially some farms use harsh chemicals, and even regular people would use harsh chemicals. But mostly I'd say factories, with their the chemicals and pollution they're putting out into our environment. Bees are, they are going, and people know that they're going. And that's why we really want to do the book. At the end of the book, you'll see that there's ways to help our environment. And by using recyclable products and doing different things, we can help our environment and try and stop pollution and try and stop climate change, which will bring bees back.
Are these, and some of these practices on how we can help the environment through recycling, etc., are these some of the things that you do in your sort of like everyday life, or what types of things do you do?
Oh, I do try and help the environment a lot. I try not to use too much plastic. We have metal bottles and bamboo beakers and different things like that. And we have rainwater harvesting as well. Especially in Ireland, you get a lot of rain, and nowadays we have loads. So that fills up our tank, and we use that for our water. And We try not to use too much plastic, and we keep our butter wrappers and use that for baking. We do lots of different things, and we try and reuse things as much as we can. Especially, like, for example, toothpaste. We cut that in half and get the toothpaste out of there, and we try and do lots of things that will sustain us for as long as we can before we throw them out.
And I think that you mentioned some ways in the book in which people can assist bees. What kind of things can our listeners do to help bees?
Well, for starters, you could leave maybe a patch of your lawn uncut and unmaintained, let it grow wild. Bees prefer wildflowers rather than the perfect, you know, flowers you get in shops. And you could try not to use chemicals. If you're gardening, try and do a bit of manual labour instead of the easy spread some chemicals. Try and pull out your weeds instead. And you could plant some wildflowers. This book comes with a little pack of seeds and shows you how to plant them, so you could grow them. And it's a great way for children to learn about gardening as well as bringing bees into your garden.
Tell us more about the pack of seeds. What seeds do you have in there?
They're just a pack of wildflower seeds, and they come with each book with a label of how to plant them. So anyone can go to your garden. You can put it in a pot and have it outside for bees if you live in a smaller house, or if you have a big garden, plant it maybe by a wall, and it can grow up and attract loads of bees to your garden, especially the wildflowers, and that can help bring bees to your area.
That sounds terrific, guys. I mean, you've really done your research. Hannah, you visited primary schools to show them your book and did readings to classes. What reaction did you get from pupils?
They were really enthusiastic. I went to kind of first to third class, and I was kind of a bit wary. Maybe they won't raise their hand, they'll be really quiet. But they all asked so many questions, and I was there for ages. And they liked listening to the story, and they liked the idea of the colourful pictures. And they're all really enthusiastic, so a lot of great feedback.
And so did you find the primary school children had a good awareness of bees and how they pollinate flowers, for example?
They did. Of course, not the really intricate details, but they had a basic idea that you need bees to pollinate and other insects to pollinate flowers and plants as well. So the children did know that, and they did understand what the bees do, but they love learning other details and other facts about the bees and the bees' kind of life story. I'd say they'd like to bring that into their life, you know, bees and flowers and that.
Fantastic. I'm going to ask you to read a passage from the book. Is that okay?
Okay. Betty Bee is sleeping soundly, but not for long. It's morning and time for work. Little Bee is going to wake her up. It's Little Bee's first day at work today. Little Bee and I are going to work together today. It's Little Bee's first time. Honeybees live until they are 6 weeks old. That doesn't sound very old. Forager bees who go outside the hive to collect nectar start at 3 weeks old, and Little Bee turned 3 weeks old yesterday. What flowers will we visit today, Betty? Bees like lots of different flowers, such as lavender, daffodil, roses, wildflowers, and much more.
Perfect. That's great. Thank you very much, Hannah. Niamh, you took third prize for your book in the Offaly Student Enterprise Awards. What do you think impressed the judges most?
I think it was that we knew so much about the book when we were being interviewed. Like, we knew everything about all the bees and the environment, and we really seemed to care about what we were talking about. It wasn't just some thing we were just randomly talking about. We wanted to be there, and we wanted to show them how we were helping bees and educating children.
You were offered a place to sell your book at the Tullamore Show. Are there any other ways that you'd like to look at, other ways of getting your book out there?
Well, we really were very pleased with how we were able to sell a ton more show, and we'd definitely do that again. And we'd love to do more shows, like potentially the Ploughing or something even bigger, so we could showcase our books to not just people locally, but more nationwide.
So tell us, Hannah, if people want to get a copy of the book, where do they go?
We do sell a few times in the Bridge Centre Tullamore and the Bank of Ireland Tullamore, and right now we have some books in Midlands Books Tullamore and Linda O'Brien's in Ballinamere. And also like to thank Garode in Robbins. We had our books there, and he was a great help to us selling the books. And also the Bee Society and Dermid Guinean from Brosna Press. He was a great help in printing our book. And then, of course, Emma Lynham, the other member of our business who couldn't be here today. So just a hi to Emma, and thanks to her. And we'd also like to say we have our Facebook page, A Bee's Life, and Instagram page, Buzzing Bees.
That's terrific, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for having us.
And you can find details of A Bee's Life on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now I have a question for you. How many times have you been out for a walk only to come across an animal in distress? Perhaps it's a young bird that's fallen out of a nest, a hedgehog wandering around during the day, or a seal pup stranded on a beach, just like the one I'm on now. What would you do? Would you ring the Gardaí, the local SPCA, or maybe a local wildlife rehabilitation organisation? Nationally, there are many excellent rehabilitation groups run by a small number of very dedicated people. And not so long ago, a conference organised by Wildlife Rehabilitation Ireland took place in Sonarta, County Meath. Rehabilitators from all over the country met to share ideas and, more importantly, to gain valuable knowledge and seek practical advice from experts. It's also hoped that a national wildlife hospital will be established within the next few years. Terry Flanagan was there on our behalf.
If I could talk to the animals, just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee. Imagine talking.
Caroline Kuehl, you're the event organiser here today. Tell me what's going to happen.
It's called WILD to start off with. It's Wildlife Information and Learning Day. And basically, this year, it being the second year, it's completely devoted to rehabbers or wildlife rehabilitators. So the whole day is basically centred on them to give them practical advice and to also give them an opportunity to socialise and to network with other rehabbers, because the job itself is quite a lonely one, in that, and often an unsung hero type of job as well, in that they, you know, they may not have the experience on certain things and they need the advice, and an opportunity like this will allow them to meet other people who have that advice.
You're just bringing them all together.
Yeah.
You're bringing bat people together and mammal people and bird people and seal
people. Everyone together under the one roof.
You've got some really exciting things going on. You've got an app, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah. Fergal Timmen and Simulation Ireland have developed a wildlife incident app. So he's going to be running through that with the rehabbers. So they'll know how to use it in the future so they can use it in their day-to-day kind of looking after injured and orphan animals and birds. So great.
And I know Heidi Bedell will be here today. What's she doing?
So she's going to be giving a talk basically about the Wildlife Hospital Project and giving an update.
Explain a bit about the Wildlife Hospital Project.
They've already got a green site for it, and so now the whole fundraising is going to start. So it's going to be a wildlife rehabilitation and training hospital. So it's going to be like a central hub, basically, for rehabbers all over the country.
And
so
where will that be based?
That's going to be in the Fingal area.
Right.
So it's very exciting. It's all starting now.
And then when that's up and running, you'll be able to bring any wild animal that's injured to there?
It's going to act as a hub, so I think that the technical side of it is going to have to be sorted out, but all the rehabbers will have connections with that centre, and also they'll be doing courses and programmes there to educate not just professionals like vets and other volunteers and rehabbers, but also the general public will have courses there as well, so it's going to be massive. It's going to be brilliant.
So going back to today then, a number of speakers that are coming, they're speaking, I know Tina Ockney is speaking, and I know Nicola Marples is speaking. So they're just going to give their knowledge to try and help the rehabbers.
Yeah, so Tina is she's Bat Conservation Ireland, and she's not got a rehabilitation background, but she has aspects which will fit with the rehabbers and will educate them on bats, which are a species that they would not have much experience with. So it's perfect for them. And later on in the afternoon, actually, we're going to be doing a case study on bats. So it's all kind of factored in. And Nicola is going to be talking about enrichment. So enrichment and basically how to kit out an environment around an animal to help them recover better, kind of thing.
This is your second event. You had a similar event last year. I think it was over on the far side. It was in Galway.
It was in Galway, yeah.
How did it go after that?
In Bridget's Garden in Galway, actually. And it was a great event. It was actually the launch of WILD, the launch of their charity day.
What happened from last year, from that meeting?
I suppose Wildlife Rehabilitation Ireland wouldn't have been as well known of, you know, at that time, and now kind of the word is getting out. Last year was about the public getting involved. This year is completely rehabilitator kind of centric. But like, you know, we're kind of starting to get kind of a public kind of awareness going.
So 5 years' time, it's going to be a different story.
Oh, there'll be a hospital built hopefully by then, like maybe even two, who knows? But like, yeah, no, it's gaining in strength the whole time. It's a wonderful charity.
And Tina Ockney from Bat Conservation Ireland, what brings you to Sonarta on this beautiful Saturday morning?
Well, I was kindly invited here just to give a wee talk on bats in Ireland, their identification and handling.
And how many species are there now? Because there's always, is it 9 or 10 or 11?
Well, there's 9 resident bat species on the island.
Right.
And we have 2 additional species that were recorded as vagrant. So they're literally individuals that have turned up over the years.
And you're giving a talk to the wildlife rehabbers here.
Yes.
On the identification?
I'm not a rehabber myself, but because I do an awful lot of bat identification, I'm literally just asked to give a wee talk. And so it's literally just, we do, Bat Conservation Ireland do bat handling and identification training courses. So it's part of what I give from that course that I'm going to give as a presentation today.
Let's have a look, because I see you have them here in a box with you.
Well, we have some dead specimens. Yeah. Yes. All on the, I am a licensed person to have such, but I do have a number of dead specimens, just to show people, because often people don't see bats, and when they actually see the size of them, they're amazed by how such small mammals they are.
They are tiny, aren't they?
Yes,
now,
they are.
You have them here, and the wings are open, so they look a lot bigger, but if, imagining that the wings are closed, they're smaller than a mouse, some of those.
They are, like the Pipistrelle, our most common bat species, would be smaller than the thumb on your hand, while our largest bat species, the Leisler's bat, is no bigger than your middle finger. Like, it fit nice and snugly into the palm of your hand. But of course, because these are nocturnal mammals, flying around at night time, our imagination goes a little bit wild and we think these are much bigger creatures than they are. But they're only about 28, 32 centimetres long wingspan, flitting around during the hours of the night. But they're small mammals, no harm at all. They're just insect-eating animals, and they're the insectivores of the night.
And do many people come across these, maybe injured, or find them on the ground, maybe tired or cold?
They do, especially with the way the weather's been. It's been very turbulent for the last few weeks. We do get a lot of calls of grounded bats. So once a bat's on the ground, we call it a grounded bat. And the thing is, bats fall into flight. So they're designed for that. So that when they're coming out of roosts, if you're ever at a roost, you'll see that they'll fall for about 1 or 2 feet and then they fly.
A bit like a swift.
Yes, exactly. So the thing is, once a bat goes, is landed on the ground, either being hit to the ground by a sudden gust of wind, or if it's a very heavy rain shower, bats are not very good at flying in rain showers. So they end up on the ground, and they're not, if they're anyway weakened, they can't jump back into flight. Mm-hmm. So a bat on the ground needs our help. So we do encourage people, kind of with a pair of gloves or a tea cloth, gently pick that bat up. If it's during the daytime, put it into a shoebox, let it dry out, let it get its space. Offer it a wee bit of sugar water. If you have tinned dog food or tinned cat food, you can offer a wee bit of that. And when it comes to dusk, you can release it. Now, we have all this on our website, batconservationireland.org. We have a section on grounded bats, a wee video to help you how to release it, and lots of information about what to do and how to help a grounded bat.
Professor Nicola Marples from Trinity College, what brings you out to Sonarta today?
Well, I was fascinated to discover about this place. I knew nothing about it at all, but out of the blue on my email, an invitation to come and talk to a group of people who are looking at rehabilitation of wildlife came up, and I thought that would be fun, so I came.
And what will you be talking about?
I'm going to be talking about, well, really enrichments and how you keep animals so that they're ready to be rehabilitated, so that they're ready to go back into the wild.
So you'll talk to the rehabbers, they have the animals. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to enlighten them as to when the best time to let that animal go.
Well, enlighten definitely not, because they know much, much more about this than I do. But just to think about and discuss with them what you have to train the animal to be able to do before you release it, and not to assume that the animal knows everything it's going to need to know. Also, how you keep it so that the natural behaviours get expressed a lot before it leaves the captivity.
And I suppose this would be very important for young animals, maybe a young bird who's fallen out of the nest that hasn't actually been in the wild before.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of animals, surprisingly, need to learn all sorts of things. Like, we know from zoo work that monkeys, for instance, need to learn how to balance. If you don't give them perches that swing before they go into the wild, they actually fall out of the trees and die. Birds need to learn what's food and what isn't food, and I don't actually know what hedgehogs and foxes and things are, the rest of our wildlife, need to know, but these people do, and that's why I want to discuss with them the ideas about what you train the animal to do and how you might go about that training.
And again, what you would feed them while they're in captivity and what not to feed them.
Absolutely, and one of the interesting things is that the world of the populations of each species divide into ones that are fussy about new foods and ones that are not. And there seems to be a very stable balance of fussy eaters against not fussy eaters in every population. In the captivity, we may well be breeding for ones that are very fussy about their food, because we only give them 2 or 3 foods before they go out. So one of the things I'll talk to people about is the idea that maybe we need to give them a much wider range of foods before they go out, just so that the non-fussy eaters actually have a chance of surviving in captivity and go out in the right proportions.
Because there is no way of monitoring those animals. Those animals that would have been fed on a very small variety of foods. Yeah, what's the question of the wild? Yeah, you've lost them.
Absolutely, and they won't know what to do with novel food, or they may not know what to do with novel food. Alternatively, they may be the ones that just ignore novel food and will try and stick to a diet which is the same as they had in captivity. Mm-hmm. There may not be enough of that out there.
So apart from diet, what else?
All sorts of things, really. I mean, my experience is from zoos, so I was going to talk to them about what zoos are doing and then get the rehabilitators to talk to me about how they might implement those same ideas in their situation. Mm-hmm. Because it's analogous, but it's not exactly the same. So the reason why I'm here is because I'm interested in what they have to say about that, whether some of the things are not at all applicable, whether other techniques are really important for them to know about and also use.
And any one simple piece of advice that you'd be giving?
Watch the animal and think about what its natural behaviours are, because a lot of the problems in captivity are to do with boredom, and the problem with boredom can be alleviated hugely by giving them behaviours which we call appetitive behaviours, but that sounds like it's all about food. It isn't. It means behaviours that are satisfying in themselves. So if a species is very, very good at something, so if it's specialised into, I don't know, winkling caterpillars out of tiny spaces between rocks, then giving it enrichments or activities in captivity that involve winkling small things out between rocks is going to be very good, because it's A, going to teach them what they need to know for the wild, but also the skills they're going to need for the wild, but also it's going to keep them occupied. It'll keep them satisfied, so they won't get bored so easily. And if you think about it, that's totally easy for us to understand, because if you think about something you're really good at, say you're a concert pianist. A concert pianist will sit all day, not getting at all bored, playing the piano. Anybody else who's not very good at the piano will kind of do it for half an hour and then get bored. But if you're very good at something, then expressing that behaviour is in itself very satisfying.
And a happy animal is more likely to survive in the wild.
Absolutely. And a happy animal is more likely to survive in captivity too. So to get them as far as the wild, keeping them with enrichments that actually work for that species is really important. And so thinking about what that species does in the wild and giving it the opportunity to do that in captivity is the key to the whole problem.
Dan Donher of Kildare Animal Foundation, why are you here today? Surely you're not coming to learn something. You may be giving these talks that you've done so much rehabilitation.
I'm here to meet other rehabbers from around Ireland and get to know, you know, network and we'll be able to help each other then and down the line. So that's why I'm here today.
You must have rescued, rehabbed and released hundreds of different animals. What's the most interesting story that you have that you can tell us?
It's funny that you say that, Terry. Just last night we released a young barn owl that we got in 2 months ago. One of our volunteers was called to a veterinary clinic and picked up the owl and opened the box, and the owl was on its back, practically looking dead. So she asked the vets to just check over before she left, and the vets came back and said, unfortunately, the owl had passed. So she asked, could she have the body back, because she knows we do some teaching with cadavers and stuff. So she brought it back to the centre, and I had a look at it and checking it over, and its claw slightly moved, just slightly, and I said, I got the stethoscope out and a faint heartbeat there. So got the incubator on, got him warmed up, gave him some fluids and brought him home with me for 2 weeks, just really round the clock care, and then started slowly but surely come around. So the last few weeks we've had it in a pre-release pen, getting up its flight muscles, and just last night then we went and released him, and off she went.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was amazing.
When you saw that owl first, did you think it was dead?
Looking in the box, I thought it was dead, yeah.
And it was cold?
It was cold, yeah, cold, on its back.
Do you think had happened to it in the first place?
So we think it was found on a roadside, so we reckon a car had clipped it or got caught in the kind of wind and flipped over, so
and
had a head injury.
Was there any obvious damage to the animal?
Absolutely not. It looked perfect. So it was just some kind of head injury, we reckon it had.
Yeah, stunned.
Stunned, yeah, so...
And came back to life.
It came back to life.
Lazarus,
yes.
Did you call it Lazarus?
One of the volunteers did.
And you actually videoed it?
We did, yeah. We have a nice video of releasing it and going off into
the
wild.
We can put that up on the website. What do you hope for from today?
I hope that everybody gets to network together, gets to know each other. It's a small community in Ireland, rehabbers, so it's important that we all work together and help out. Some people might be able to take certain species where maybe I would be able to take them, or if I'm too full, maybe I could pass them on to someone else. So I think it's really important that everyone gets to know each other and works together.
Thank you, Terry. More details on that and all the items covered on today's programme can be found on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, goodbye.